Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How's Trey?
Hi. Oh, everything's fine. I spent this afternoon teaching two of my grandsons how to sing Itsy Bitsy Spider with all the hand motions.
Oh, nice.
So that's how my afternoon went.
Well, see, not having grandchildren of my own, that's something I didn't get to do.
Except, well,
with my
over.
Son. You know, yeah. You know, my son's 30. Oh, that's pretty bad. I can't remember my son. He's 32.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, all right. Yeah. Regroup. Think about what I was doing. Put my paranormalist face back on. Although I enjoy talking about stuff like that. That's okay. And if our listeners and subscribers also enjoy listening to Patty and I talk back and forth, mostly Patty talking, though, during this, if you would please click the subscribe button that's down below. If you're not already subscribed, if you are subscribed, thank you very much. We do appreciate your listenership, viewership. Click the like, the bell. And everything down below in the description, there's a link to the Linktree, which takes you to our Facebook pages, our Patty's blog, email address link, buy me a coffee. Again, no obligation, but it's there. And I think nothing else new to report, other than the fact that after our last episode, I did go onto Amazon and purchase the Kindle book for Wendigo lore. And have been enjoying that so far. So there was a link to that in last week's show notes. So if you would like to have a look at that book, that the direct link for that is there as well. So you can tell this isn't scripted, people.
No, not at all.
Okay. So I think with that, I've said way more than I would like to because it's been a long day for me today and it's not even that late yet. So, but anyway, as always, I like to be surprised with what the topic is, and tonight's topic is...
Ghosts, of course. We haven't spent any time with our paranormal friends lately.
Ah, it's like an old comfortable sweater. Yeah.
It is. It is indeed. So we are coming into October, first day, and no better way to celebrate the beginning of the October month than with some ghostly tales. So... I found some, I think, very interesting stories, and I thought I would share them with you. So this one is called the Mackenzie River Ghost. This is from the Northwest Territories of Canada, but I found it to be an interesting story. So there was a gentleman by the name of Augustus Richard Pierce, who was a very well-to-do gentleman in the 1850s. He passed away in 1853, and his final wishes were that his body would be transported to from the Northwest Territories on dog sled, and taken to a specific spot where he would be buried. So a gentleman was contracted to do this. His name was McFarland, and he kept a journal. And McFarland would write about his journey. Obviously, you know, you're alone with a dead body on a sled, and you're headed somewhere to bury this guy. And you can imagine that there were lots of moments whenever he probably talked to himself or the dogs or what have you. What I found interesting about the journal was this. He would record that at night after he undid the braces for the dogs and he was trying to settle them down for the night. He would get something to eat and try to warm up himself. And he would hear what he called a ghostly, compelling voice, urging the dogs to keep running, even though there was nobody around. So it was as though this man, Augustus Pierce, was trying to hurry them along so he could make it to his final destination.
Long before the advent of any recording devices for EVP. Yeah.
Indeed. But it is interesting. And, you know, there was absolutely nobody. It's not like it's some place where you could accidentally mistake what somebody was saying. You know, you're talking about in the middle of nowhere. I just thought that was a fascinating story. I can't imagine how one would deal with that out in the middle of the frozen tundra.
Yeah, I think a big difference is hearing it with your ears versus hearing it in your head. Because you've told way too many stories of late about hearing things in your head. So, the djinn, the Wendigo, yes, all kinds of things that I just don't want to think about anymore.
Well, sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I'm not going to wig out, so don't worry.
I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So today we don't think much about ventriloquists or ventriloquist dummies, but in the early 1900s, there were a lot of people who made a living as ventriloquists. They traveled with circuses or put on shows. They did radio shows. Probably the cream of the crop was Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. So for those who don't know, Edgar Bergen was a real man. And you might recognize his daughter's name, Candace Bergen. And he had this ventriloquist dummy that he named Charlie McCarthy. And they would do these skits. And Charlie was always the wise, cracking, you know, smart aleck. And he made a fortune with this persona. That's how he made his living. So there was a young woman by the name of Marty who shared a story that I thought was fascinating. So back in the 1990s, she had stumbled upon Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and she was fascinated as this child. She listened to the radio shows. She you know, watched what she could see about them. She just really was obsessed with the whole concept. So one day, her dad's in a local magic shop because the little girl liked magic as well. And he finds a ventriloquist dummy that's reminiscent of Charlie McCarthy. Doesn't look exactly like him, but very close. Mm-hmm. So her birthday's coming up, and he says to the cashier, I want that dummy in the window there. Can I have it? And they brought it out, boxed it up. And as she's ringing up this man, she says to the man, you know, when someone puts their hand inside that doll, he comes alive. And the guy laughed and he said, of course he does, you know, because, you know, that's what happens. You put your hand inside, you make it talk, and it moves its head, and there's a little, so you can make it move its head and, you know, look up and down and do different things. So he didn't think a whole lot of it. And he took it home for her birthday. He gave it to her. And she went crazy. This was just the most amazing gift ever for this little girl. And she would sit and she would talk to it. She would play with it. She would try to make it talk. She wasn't obviously very good at it. But, you know, she gave it her best shot at her age, about 10-year-old little girl. And every night she insisted that it be locked in this cabinet in the hallway so that it would be safe until she could come and get it out in the morning. So it became a ritual, and that's important because this was a nightly ritual. And anybody who's ever had a kid with a ritual, you know, if you throw them off their schedule with this ritual, they will cry bloody murder about it because it breaks their pattern. So she said every night she would put this doll, this ventriloquist doll, into the cabinet. Her mom would make a show of locking the door, and that was that. And she said over the time she had it, she began to notice that it would change expressions. Now, it's not possible for it to change expressions. It's molded plastic. But, and then some of the older ones were carved wood, which, yeah, would be even worse. But she insisted that it would change its smile, it would frown, it would, like, move its eyebrows, things that it couldn't literally do. And it didn't frighten her, though. She just thought it was part of the magic and the charm of this ventriloquist dummy. She was too young to, I guess, see the significance of it. So one night, she's upstairs in her bed, and everybody else is in bed as well, and they hear this pitter-patter downstairs in the living room. And they're thinking one of the pets that were supposed to be put away for the night in the laundry room had gotten out or something like this. So they go downstairs, her parents, and she follows along behind them. And there's the dummy sitting in the living room on the couch, just sitting there. And her parents were like, did you get this out of the cabinet? And her mom's like, well, she couldn't have gotten it out of the cabinets because I have the key. And her dad's looking at it, and he's looking at his wife, and he's looking at the little girl, and he's like, well, then you must not have put it away tonight. And her mother's like, of course we put it away tonight. We do it every night. She sits it in, she kisses it on the cheek and tells it she'll see it in the morning, and I lock the door. Well, that makes no sense. So they just kind of left it there. And then a few days later, her dad's brother, her uncle, was at the house, and he's there by himself. He's waiting for her dad to show up. And he would later tell this story. He's sitting there. Now, when she's in school, the dummy is likewise locked up. And she was in school at that point in time. So she wouldn't have gotten it out yet that day, because she would have had to get ready for school, and they wouldn't take it out of the cabinet and distract her from getting ready. So her uncle's sitting there, and he's in the living room, and he's waiting, and he hears somebody calling his voice. So he goes out to the hallway, and he's listening. It sounds a little bit like his brother, he thinks. And he steps back into the living room, and sitting on the couch is the doll that hadn't been there a moment before. Well, that pretty much did it for everybody. And the doll was just grinning at him. So when his brother gets home, he tells them this crazy story about this doll and that it moved. It, you know, it wasn't there. And then he stepped into the doorway and was listening to figure out where the voice was. And then the doll suddenly is there behind him. And there's something wrong with this thing, right? And it scared everybody. So after that, they would hear it moving three or four different more times. And then the dad decided that that was it. We're getting rid of this thing. So they decided the best thing to do wasn't to sell it and send whatever evil was with this thing to others, but to get rid of it. So they took it out and they laid it on the barbecue grill, and they put lighter fluid over it, and they lit it, except it wouldn't light. And they dropped match,
of course,
after match after match. Didn't do a thing. Didn't even smolder. Well, when that didn't work, her dad got a big kitchen knife, and he tried to cut it in pieces. But you couldn't cut it. So he decided that if that wasn't going to work, he'd bag it up, and he stuck it in the trash can that was going out that day. And she saw it. She cried. She said, "Oh, please don't get rid of my doll." And he put her on the bus, and he said, "It's over." So when he went to take the trash can back a couple hours later, he opens up the trash can to sit in a bag of garbage that had been made while the gang was down at the bottom of the driveway. And there lays the doll, not wrapped up, but there lays the doll, completely clean, no lighter fluid, no cut marks, just laying there. So it was decided that the only thing they could do to put this doll to rest was to literally encase it in stone. So they dug a hole in the backyard, got some quickcrete, threw a layer of quickcrete in, shoved the doll down into it, and covered it over with more quickcrete until it was encapsulated completely. And she said that was it. That was the end of it. They filled up the hole with cement. And to this day, that's where the doll is. She said, but you can't help but wonder if one day somebody will chip it out, or it will find a way to get out and find her family once more.
So do you personally have any idea? Was it something possessing the doll or something else? I guess if the activity stopped, then it was probably the doll itself.
Yeah.
Not something externally, you know, to the doll that was using it.
And I think part of it might have been animated. I mean, it sounds like it had something going on prior, because the way the cashier spoke. Mm-hmm. But then giving it all of that information, that love, that obsession that child was pouring into it, really fed it energy as well.
Yeah, you know? I'm just thinking that, okay, but nothing really bad happened. It was just bizarre.
Bizarre and intimidating. They found it themselves to be intimidated by what was occurring. And I would find myself intimidated by what was occurring. Although its next stop wouldn't be a pile of concrete. It would be John Zaffis's Haunted Possessed Objects Museum. I'd be like, John, you want this thing? Because if you don't, I know what I'm doing with it.
Mm-hmm. I think, didn't Bergen also have Mortimer Snerd?
Believe he did. And he also, I think Candace Bergen did an interview years ago in which she talked about the fact that she envied the relationship her father and that doll had, that he would sit and talk to it for endless hours, and that she actually had begun to believe, and had they had some events happen that made her think that there was something obsessive about the doll.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And it's true, though, you don't hear many ventriloquists lately. And in fact, I was hard pressed. I can think of three names in the modern era.
Yeah.
Jeff Dunham, yep. Terry Fader, and Darcy Lynn.
The only one I knew was Jeff Dunham, because my boys always enjoyed his work.
Oh, me too. But, yeah.
Yeah, so that, but I thought it was a really interesting story, and it's really creepy, you know.
And that's not the only creepy doll story that you've told too. Just
no, there's an entire genre of dolls, and you know, not just dolls, but stuffed bears. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to like John's museum, or the one that his aunt and uncle had, the Warrens, there's all kinds of stuffed toys that are there. And I know that John, there's a clock, a big, long, large grandfather clock, which is possessed by the spirit of the man who owned it. I have a good friend who was with me. We went there one time, and she was taking just hundreds of pictures throughout the whole place. Mm-hmm. And she caught his face looking out of the glass of the clock, the glass belly of the clock, looking at us. And there were only three people in the room, in the building at that time. It would be her, myself, and John. And John and I were in the second room over. She was in the third, just snapping pictures by herself. And I assure you, she did not look at all like a bewhiskered old man. She's a very lovely young woman. And it was quite interesting. But just something animates certain objects. And dolls do have a creepy feel to them, because they look realistic most of the time.
So one last question, and then I'll let you get back to
your, that's okay.
Your stories. So you said you've been in his museum, and you being sensitive yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was your take? What did you feel? What did you experience when you were there?
Okay, so you need to know that John has a way of protecting people. That's why it's safe for you to go through it. So mm-hmm. he's got them kind of boxed up. But there were a couple of, there was one teddy bear in particular that I kept going back to, and he laughed and he said, oh yeah, that one was a tough one. And he told me, you know, about it a little bit. And there was a dress. It was I can't remember these anymore. If it's been years, I can't remember if it was red or black, but it was a slinky 1930s kind of dress. And the woman who had owned it apparently still was attached to it. And like when you got anywhere near this dress, you could just feel the energy coming off of it. And, you know, and it's nothing for him to come out to get the mail and find a box. And when he opens up the box, there's a letter, you know, attached, and it says, here's this blah, blah, blah. And they tell the story of whatever. And it's like, do you want it? If not, can you get rid of it? Mm-hmm. Which is how he ended up with the museum in the first place. Mm-hmm. People who had heard about him and, you know, and his abilities. And they were like, this is where we send it. So, yeah, it's interesting. And people might be surprised to find that, you know, the doll Annabelle was actually a Raggedy Ann doll. It wasn't what you see in the movies.
Did not know that, but yeah. Where is the museum?
John's museum is at, I don't remember the name of the place. He moved for it not too long ago. But if you look up John Zaffis's Possessed Objects Museum, you can find out. And then the Warrens had one, which is still being administered through their daughter, and her husband are monitoring it. And you can go and see it as well if you just look it up. What is the guy from the paranormal show, Zach Bagans, has a museum as well. So there's three that I know of.
Well, Mrs. Stu is always wanting to do day trips if she has a day off. So I'm just thinking that if it's within traveling distance, guess what, honey? Guess what we're going to do today?
Well, now you ruined the surprise, because I know she sometimes listens.
Well, she does listen, but that's...
Yeah. So, but on to our next story. This one's about a guy and his little boy. He wrote about, and I found this really interesting story. So this gentleman comes from Ohio, and he was driving through the area back home again, past an old cemetery that he drove through quite often. There's really nothing in the cemetery. It's just a normal looking little old cemetery sitting back off the road, and it's got some faded flowers and on the graves, you know, the normal stuff you'd see, some little plaques and praying hands, angels, the stuff you'd always find in a little cemetery. And it didn't have any special ambiance. Never heard a story about it, but he's driving by and he notices his son watching out the window very intently. His son got very quiet and he pointed at the cemetery and he said, look, Daddy, all those people. And the guy looked and he didn't see anybody. And he said, I don't see any people over there. And he said, sure, Daddy, there's lots of grandmas over there, meaning old ladies, mm-hmm. you know. And he said he looked again and slowed down and there was nothing there. So he started to, you know, put his foot on the gas. And the little boy said, didn't you see them, Daddy? They're all standing there looking down at the grass. And he said he hit the gas and took off out of there. And he didn't say anything more about it to his son. And that night they were watching TV. And the little boy said to his daddy, he kind of looked up from where he was laying on the floor watching TV. And he said, Daddy, you know those people in the cemetery? And he said, yeah, honey. He's like, you know, they weren't alive, right? And he's like, they weren't alive? No, he said, none of them were alive. And he said, well, how do you know that? And he said, I don't know. They just talked to me up here. And he said, I don't know what to make out of this. Was it his imagination? Was it, did he have sixth sense? What's going on? But he's like, he said it with absolute certainty and did not in any way appear to be joking. And, you know, he's a little boy. He's like 3 years old, 4 years old. He doesn't have the capacity to understand that he's saying something that doesn't make sense, that is impossible, that there was a group of old ladies standing there staring at the grass all hunched together and that they were dead.
And staring at the grass.
That is, I've wondered since I've read the story originally, you know, what that, if there was anything about it, they weren't looking around, they weren't chatting, they weren't milling, they were all standing there staring down at the grass.
The only thing I can think of is that friends paying their respects.
That's a possibility. An elderly woman had passed, you know, that's true. So, and our next story is something about a gentleman by the name of Captain Joseph White. So, this story takes place in front of the Gardner Pingree House in Salem, Massachusetts. Of course, everybody knows about Salem for the witch trials. We could go into that, but on another day. today we're going to talk about Captain Joseph White. So Captain Joseph was a very well-to-do merchant. He was murdered in his house. He was bludgeoned to death in his bed.
Ouch.
Ah, yeah, not a way to go. Apparently, he was murdered for his money, and he was 82 years old at the time. So he certainly had a hard, you know, it's not hard to see that he couldn't fight off his attackers, who turned out to be his younger brothers.
Oh.
Who wanted to inherit, and he wasn't dying fast enough to suit them. Hmm. So his brothers, Joseph and Francis, you know, who were trying to figure out what had happened. They didn't know because there's more than one. There's more than two brothers. They actually had hired a third party to do the murder itself because they didn't think they could pull it off themselves. And it, eventually the whole story comes tumbling out, and it's a gruesome one. That they paid off a local thug to beat their brother to death so that they could have alibis elsewhere. So it turns out that Joseph and Francis, the ones who were so set on solving the crime, turned out to be the murderers. So you can understand how devastating this murder was for the community, for the family, and I'm sure how jolting it was for poor old Captain Joseph. It is said that this murder is the murder that inspired Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, he is a great, you could see where. So anyhow, people have heard about him for years. People that have lived in the house or driven by the house claim to see an older gentleman, very distinguished, looking out the second bedroom window, second floor in the area where his bedroom would have been. People have heard him walking in the house. They've heard talking, somebody going up and down the stairs. But what I thought was really interesting is this now part of a tour. And the tourists have taken photographs of the house in every room is empty. The house is empty and locked at night. And yet they continue to take pictures and find both male and female figures in the windows or on the landing of the house, which you can, there's a window in the landing that looks outside. And they've gone in to inspect the people who own the house because of these photos, or because they've tagged along to see whether what was going on and if there's any reality to it, or if people were just getting psyched up. Nobody knows who they are. They've appeared in multiple photos over multiple years, and yet there's no resolution. So I just thought it was an interesting story. There are so many of those kinds of stories, you know, dark stories from Salem. It's just a really weird energy in that town. So we're moving on to the Bellamy Bridge in Marianna, Florida, which is said to be haunted, and the shoreline of the river there is also said to be haunted. In the 1830s, Elizabeth Ann Crome Bellamy married a local politician by the name of Dr. Samuel Bellamy. On their wedding night, her dress accidentally caught fire, and she was burned horribly. She survived a couple days and then passed away. Her husband had her buried along the Chipola River, which was an area that he and she used to walk along quite often when they were courting. And it is said that her love for her husband has kept her from resting. So she has been seen walking in white along this side of the river, but she also walks across the bridge that didn't exist at the time of her death. Oh. The bridge was built later, which I found interesting. That's what made this sound a little different. And sometimes when she's seen, it appears that she's either walking through fire or with fire surrounding her. But she walks along the riverbank, across the bridge that didn't exist in her time frame, to the other side and disappears. Yeah, I thought the normally they don't recognize much that's not in their time frame, but for some reason, she did. So this was an interesting story. This story takes place in the eastern part of New York State. And in the 1800s, there was this beautiful old farmhouse and property, and it was supposed to go to the stableman who had stayed with this old gentleman when he was, you know, not able to care for himself and was passing away. So he had willed the stableman the house and property in return for his kindness during the last years of his life. A very nice story, except that the stableman and his wife did not get to keep the house because family came in and broke the will. So they didn't get to inherit the property as per the gentleman's wishes. So this is a story told by the family of the gentleman who owned the property in the early 2000s. And she said that she and her sister had been staying the night there, and all a couple other friends. Their uncle was known to be a bit eccentric. He's very well-to-do. And they noticed a maid coming down the stairs, down the hallway, bringing towels and stuff and stopping into each room as if to put the towels into the rooms for the guests. And she noticed this in the middle of the night. Like, she woke up and saw what was going on, and the door was open to the hallway, and she saw her coming and going with the towels. And she thought, how strange. He must have hired a maid for the weekend to help take care of us. And because he was a little off the beaten path, that didn't seem like a totally preposterous idea to her. And then she saw the woman coming down the hall wearing the long brown dress and the apron of another era. And she was carrying what she described as a percolator. It sounded like a very large silver coffee pot. And she hurried along. And it was just about morning at this point when she saw her that time. So she decided to go downstairs and have a cup of coffee, if that's where the lady was headed with the, you know, the percolator. So she walks in to the dining area about 20 minutes later after she's gotten hastily dressed. And there sits her uncle and a couple of the other guests that were there for the weekend. And she looks around for the maid or the percolator. She sees neither. And she sits down and she says, "Where's the maid you hired?" And he's like, "Excuse me?" She's like, "You know, the maid, the lady that brought us the towels and, you know, and where's the coffee pot? I saw her carrying the coffee pot down the hallway upstairs, like she was going downstairs with it." And he's like, "I didn't hire a maid. What are you talking about?" And she proceeds to explain in more detail, and he grins and he says, "Come with me." So by now, I'm sure everybody at the table is quite interested in what's going on. So they all get up. Yeah, and they follow him to the living room, and there's this painting there. And he points to this and he said, "Is this who you saw?" And she looks up, and sure enough, different clothing, but definitely appears to be the same woman. And there was a man in the picture as well. And she said, "Yes, I think that is the same woman I saw." And he said, "My dear, she has been dead for about 100 years, and proceeds to tell them the story about how the stableman and his wife had been caretakers there, had cared for this man. So after death, she continued to haunt the building, obviously still as the servant, never got to be the mistress of the house." Kind of sad that she never got her wish. Well-to-do greedy family broke the will. They didn't say it, but I would imagine that they argued that he wasn't in his right state of mind to have signed the will at that point in time. That would be a good bet. The next story is one that I thought was interesting because it could have happened to anyone. So when you're driving along, you know, and you see an accident, it's human nature to look. You know, you see a car accident and you look. And some people look maliciously. Some people look with trepidation. Some people are like, "Dear Lord, I hope everybody got out of that." But we look. And this young woman is telling her story of driving out to meet some friends. And she's in traffic when there's this huge slowdown in the traffic. And finally, the traffic begins to move again. And as she gets closer to the area where whatever happened, she realizes there was a bad accident. And they've now got the cars pushed to the berm of the road, and they're cleaning up the glass, and they're letting traffic flow in at least one lane. And her thought was pretty much what everybody else's is: "Dear Lord, I hope nobody died in this." And a couple seconds later, she catches a motion from the corner of her eye, and she looks, and there's a woman suddenly sitting in the car in the passenger seat right beside her, who hadn't been there a moment before. She said she was absolutely in shock, but she couldn't stop because there's traffic pushing behind her, there's traffic going ahead, and cops blowing his whistle and waving them through. And so she's just kind of white knuckling it and like looking over and keeping her eye on the road and looking over and keeping her eye on the road. And she said the woman looked frightened, bemused. Her exact words were something along the line: she looked like somebody who just ended up in somebody else's car and didn't know how it had happened. So she said she had no options. So the woman turned to her and audibly said, "How did I get here?" And she said, "At that moment, I glanced at her and looked a little longer." And she said she had this slight glow around her, white glow. And she said, "I don't know what came over me, but I got extremely calm. And I said, 'Ma'am, just calm down. My name's Julia, and I'm here to help you. And I think you need to know that you were in that car accident that I just passed. And you need to get out of my car and go toward the light. Just go toward the light, and you'll be okay.'" And she said, "I finally found an opening at that point. I pulled over, and I said to her again, 'Please just go to the light.'" She said the woman just blinked at me a couple times and then just faded away. Now, of course, she's more than a little interested as to what happened in this accident, who died and what have you. So she made a point of getting the local newspaper, watching the local newscast. And in the paper, there's a picture of the woman who died in the car accident and a picture of this young lady passing the scene of the accident just at the moment the photographer took the picture. And so it's her car going past the accident site. And she said, "I can only think that in that moment, she didn't know what else to do and suddenly found herself in my car. And I hope I helped her to go to the light."
See, those are the stories I want to hear.
Well, there's always good stories and there's bad stories. And mm-hmm. I try to keep a little bit of a balance, but there aren't really exactly any happy Wendigo stories. You know what I'm saying?
I get it. Yeah.
So we had to go with what we had. Mm-hmm. So the next one is one that kind of is near and dear to me. I have always wondered why we don't believe our children when they tell us things. Like, I've talked about the story of the little boy who disappeared up on that mountain, and he kept telling his dad there was something in the woods. And then he was sent down to feed the chickens one night, and there was a yell, and they heard the pan drop, and then he never was found. Those stories. And, you know, one of the things that is the quintessential kid story is there's somebody under my bed or somebody in my closet. And that's what this story is about. So this gentleman's passing on a story that he doesn't remember. He was very little. But his mother would tell him about it from time to time. And she said that when he was a little boy, about 2 or 3, he would come running in the middle of the night and want to climb in bed with her and her husband. And he would be sobbing, "There's a man in my closet. There's a man in my closet. Mommy, come and see." She would go over and she would look, and there was never anything there. So she would, you know, try to get him to sleep in his own bed, and he would absolutely refuse. And then just to make everybody have a chance to sleep that night, he'd finally get tucked up in bed with his mom and dad and go to sleep. As he got slightly older, he began to be able to give a little better description. And then he saw a picture one day, and he pointed at it in a book, and he said, "That's how the man in my closet dresses. That's how the man dresses." And it was a picture of a man in Civil War clothing from the North. So the blue clothing. And it was kind of unnerving or off-putting. So the mother did a little research, and she started talking to neighbors, and eventually found out that prior to the last family leaving that house, they had had experiences with a man from the Civil War, and that they had found artifacts from the Civil War tucked in the walls of the house and had turned them over to the local historical society. And all she could wonder is, you know, is he there looking for his stuff? Did that agitate him? What's going on? But I thought it was an interesting story because the little boy had no contexting for it, but he kept insisting there was a man hiding in the closet.
Yeah, I'm one of those parents that, having had paranormal experiences as a young child, I was way more inclined to listen to my son telling stories. Now, he was very good at fabricating things too, but I could tell the difference between something that was fabricated and something that actually happened. Usually. You know, so, but he never really had any paranormal experiences. But, you know, so because of that, I was more willing to listen, at least, mm-hmm. you know, and not just, you know, dispense it as, you know, that's your imagination.
Yeah. I mean, I've had those moments with my sons. I've told you the story about my youngest was about, I don't know, 6 or 7. We were driving home one night, and up and in Claysburg, there's a couple places where there's four ways, but this is the one right before the grocery, right before you get to the grocery store. And as we're driving through it, it's like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night on our way home. We had done a paranormal investigation that night, and it was a more for fun one. I would bring the kids to the ones that I thought were for fun and safe, okay. You know, not to the ones that I thought were dangerous. And so it was like just kind of everybody getting together and hanging out and just having fun. Investigation. And we had had a friend of ours who was supposed to be there who had called and said, "Hey, I'm not going to make it. Something's happened to a friend of mine. I need to go deal with it." So I hadn't given it another thought. I figured, you know, she was dealing with what she needed to, and that was the end of that. But on the way home, like I said, we got to that intersection. My son's sound asleep in the back seat of the car. And all of a sudden, he just sits straight up and he goes, "Mommy, there's a lady here. She died here tonight." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" And I'm stopped at the red light there. And he goes, "She told me so, and I can see her." And I didn't see anything. And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for that, Benji. You know, it's okay." And then we drove off when the light turned green. And about, I don't know, 30, 40 seconds later, he slid back down on the seat, pulled the blanket back over him, and went back to sleep. Because this is back whenever you didn't have to wear seatbelts all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so he's just all cuddled up in the back seat. His brother's in the front seat with me. And I get home. I get them tucked safely into bed. And just as I'm laying down to go to sleep, my friend calls, the one that was missing the group meeting that night.
Right.
And she says, "I'm so sorry to have canceled on you so late. but I wanted to tell you what happened. One of my friends was killed about 6 o'clock in the evening, you know, up there in Claysburg at that intersection by the grocery store. And I said, yeah. She's like, yeah, she was in a head-on collision and she died there. And I said, I see. Well, I hope she finds her way home, sweetheart, to heaven. And she goes, thank you. That's so kind. And I didn't want to tell her because what good would it have done for her to worry? But I found it fascinating that my son, you know, sat up and just was absolutely giving me detail by detail what had happened to this lady.
That was a good story in its own right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting because he literally sat bolt upright and just started talking. And then just like it was passed through him, he went right back to sleep. Like if I saw a dead lady standing outside the car, I don't know that I would have gone back to sleep. I'd have just sat there and waited. You know, like, not interested in going to sleep now. No, thank you. So our next story comes from a couple. It's a young couple. And it's the typical story of you buy a place because it's cheap. You know, so they bought this old church because it was cheap and decided to turn it into a business on the first floor. And then to use what would have been like the rabbit warren of rooms in the basement level as their apartment. So they're sitting in their apartment one night. Her husband's like outside the apartment in a little patio area that they had built. And they had remodeled the whole thing by themselves. They had done everything because they just simply couldn't afford someone else to do the work. And he's sitting outside and she's sitting in the house and she's in the living room and she's messing with the computer and her cell phone and what have you. And all of a sudden, the record player, because they still had a classic record player, the record player clicked itself on. By the way, they're making a comeback. And
I have one. It's up there somewhere.
they're selling vinyl at Walmart again.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so she's sitting there and the record player's off and she's just, you know, putzing around on her computer. And all of a sudden, the record player clicks itself on and then she hears a voice singing, even though it's not what's on the record player. And she said, it started to sing. And it said, Hi, my name is Katie. I'm not sure, she said, but I was trying to pay attention. And then it said, how old? She said, I'm so many years old. And she said where she was from in the song. And she said, but I couldn't hear all the specifics. I could just hear certain parts, like it faded in and out. And she said, this went on for 2 or 3 minutes. And then as the song starts to fade out, she hears her sing, but something's hurting me. And she said, I looked up at the stereo and I'm thinking, is my husband doing this somehow? Did he wire it? You know, what's going on? And then she hears a voice singing, something's killing me. Something killed me. And then at this point, she's completely, you know, goose pimples, which I would have been too. And she said, I got up and I went out and I said, and I'm thinking, I'm going to catch him at this. And she's going out the door. She hears, please, someone tell my parents, tell the teachers, tell the corrections officer. And she said, I paused at that. Like, what are you talking about? And she said, I just took off down the room yelling at my husband, how dare you? And she bursts outside and she's telling him, you know, don't play jokes with me about dead people. Don't do that. That's not funny. That was terrifying. And he's looking at her like she's insane. And he says, you know, I didn't do anything. I had nothing to do with it. So they go back in and they're looking to see if maybe somebody else had messed with it or had picked up a signal from elsewhere. And she said, I don't know. We had lots of things happen in this building, this old church. Footsteps, doors opening, closing, stuff like that. But on that night, she said, that's the night I became a believer. Because when I pulled the table out that the record player was on, she said, my husband grabbed the cord and pulled it out. And she said, it wasn't in the wall. It wasn't even plugged in. And to this day, she doesn't know who Katie was or the corrections officer or any of this stuff. She only knows that that record player wasn't plugged in and was completely incapable of getting a signal. And yet, there it was.
Yeah, so that being in a, well, I guess, you know, if a church is being converted into a business or living space, it's been deconsecrated.
Yeah,
so
I think.
Yeah, so that the possibility of something pretending to be, yeah, would probably not be likely, but
it's still possible. But I just think it's fascinating. Like, these were specifics.
Yes. Yeah. Huh?
Tell this. Tell my parents. Tell the teachers. Tell the correction officer.
Yeah, the corrections officer. That's, boy, that's bewildering. Yeah.
Yeah, like what happened to who? How, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, you can see tell my parents, tell the teachers. But then how does that relate to a corrections officer?
Unless it was an escaped convict that committed some atrocity. Yeah,
possibly. But anyhow, I just thought it was had an odd element to it. So I thought I would share that story. Mm-hmm. So this next story, and this is the next to the last one we're going to tell tonight. So this story was about a young girl. She was about 10 years old when her parents bought their home. And in the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to the house being moved into, her dad would go over every couple of days and see how the repairs and the painting and all that stuff was being dealt with. And one day she rode along with her dad and they went through the house, and everything was pretty much like it had been the day before. The painters were painting, the, you know, repairs were being made, and they went down to the basement, and in the basement they saw a man painting the hot water heater. And she said, I was only 10, but I thought it was very odd. Why would you paint a hot water heater? And she said something to her dad, and he's like, oh, don't be silly, let's just keep going. And she's like, but I saw him clearly painting a hot water heater. So they moved in about 3 weeks later, and you know, the first few days are like that welter of putting stuff away and what have you. You know how that goes. And everybody was just busy, so nobody was paying any attention to anything. And after a couple of weeks in the house, she had a day that she didn't feel very well, and her parents had let her stay home from school. She's 10, and they, you know, they told her that she could play with her dolls, she could color in her book, but they had to go to work for a few hours, and they would check on her by phone off and on throughout the day. They bought her a brand new pack of 64 crayons, and she was very meticulous about keeping her crayons in place. Everybody had a friend who was that kid, you know, or you were that kid, one of the two. And so she's sitting there coloring, and she's looking for her blue crayon. And she's like, I don't want periwinkle. I don't want, you know, any other color. I want my blue crayon. And it's missing. So she begins to search for it. And she can't find it anywhere. It's a brand new box. She literally opened it up that morning. And that's very puzzling to her. She thinks, well, maybe they didn't put a blue crayon in the box. But a few days go by. You know, it could have been a mistake. Something screwed up at the Crayola factory or something. So she just didn't know what to make of it because it should have had a blue crayon. There was a space for it, but there was no blue crayon. So a few days later, she goes down to the basement with her mom to go do the laundry. And in doing so, her mom went into the little area, the little alcove area where the hot water heater was, because she stored extra supplies back in there. And she had laundry soap and stuff back there. So she ran in there to grab a new box of laundry soap, and that's whenever the little girl froze. Laying on top of the hot water heater was the blue crayon. And written on the hot water heater were these words, Hi, Fitner 6, Kevin, Fitner 6, FITNURS, and the number 6, all in one word. Hi, Fitner 6, Kevin. So I don't know what he was trying to spell, but Kevin couldn't spell. So she said she got confused, and her mom growled her and said, what were you doing down here in the basement, and why is your crayon on top of the hot water heater? And she's like, I told her, I don't know, and left it at that. So she goes back to school the following day. And of course, she's telling everybody about the new house and that they just moved in, yada, yada, yada. And somebody made a connection between the new house and said, oh, you live in Kevin's house. And she said, I don't live in Kevin's house. I live in my house. And they said, no, Kevin used to go to school with us. So it turned out that the year before, Kevin had been a boy in the same grade and class as this little girl ended up in. And he had been out in his front yard playing when there had been a hit and run, and a car veered into his yard, clipped him, and kept off on going. And she said after that, she began to watch for the notes. Anytime you would leave papers and pens or any kind of writing implement out, he would write messages on the paper or on an object. He would open and close doors. He would adjust the old thermostats, you know, the circular ones you would turn. And then she said he would turn on the Christmas music whenever that would be gotten out for the holidays. And every time she would go out, no matter how still the air, in the backyard there was a set of swings, and only the left swing would be moving slowly back and forth, no matter what. And she said, you know, obviously it was scary. And one night her cat was in her bedroom and all of a sudden started hissing at the door, and it woke her up, and the door flew open on its own. She didn't see anybody, but the cat spit and carried on and dashed past whatever it thought it was seeing and took off out of the room. And she said she just kind of laid there paralyzed, like she didn't know what to do, finally fell back to sleep. And when she asked her parents about why they had opened her bedroom door, they said, "We didn't open your bedroom door. We didn't go in there at all last night." She said, so she was very unnerved by it. As the years went by, she grew up and ended up graduating from high school, still living in that house. And she said one Christmas break when she was in her late teens, she was struggling a lot with depression. And she was thinking of committing suicide, and she was running it through her head. You know, if I took the pills in the medicine cabinet, would that be enough to kill me or just make me sick? The stuff that a kid would think about if they were in a bad place. And she said all of a sudden, a policeman knocked on the door downstairs and insisted that they needed to talk to the girl. They have a young daughter living in this house, and her father was like, yes. And they're like, well, there was a kid who stopped us on the street and said that the girl in this house was going to commit suicide. And he said, a kid? He said, yeah, a little boy about 8 years old. And he was crying and he was saying we needed a hurry. So could we talk to your daughter, please? And she said, I'm absolutely certain it was Kevin. And he could hear my thoughts. And he sent the police to save me that night.
Any idea who the man was painting the water heater?
No clue, but that was her first oddity in the house. So the next and our last story is the story of a gentleman by the name of Tom Thompson. Back in Canada we go. And he
I'm not going to Canada. No.
Well, this one's not so bad, I promise. Okay. All right. So he was part of a group of people who were inspired by the wilderness. And he spent a great deal of time out in the Canadian wilderness. One of the places he liked to go was a place called Canoe Lake. And this is where whatever tragedy befell him. So in early July of 1917, he was out on Canoe Lake early in the morning. He had done this literally dozens and dozens and dozens of times. This was a guy who was wilderness hardened, and he knew how to navigate the lakes of Canada in a canoe. So he was definitely experienced. But somebody finds his canoe, his gray canoe, flipped upside down, floating slowly across the lake. So they flip the canoe back up, take it to the local hotel that's at the end of the one end of the lake, and ask if this canoe belongs to them. And they said, oh my gosh, yeah. And Tom Thompson took it out. That was always the canoe he asked for. And they said, well, you know, it didn't look good because the canoe was empty and whoever was in it wasn't there. So they began to look around the lake and the wilderness and what have you for him, thinking they would find either him or his body. They did not. So he's apparently never floated out to the surface. Now, for those who think, what happens to the body is it is heavy by nature, so it sinks to the bottom. But after a couple days, gases build up from decomposition. I can't talk. And then you float to the surface. So even if he had fallen out of the canoe, had sunk to the bottom of the lake, odds are in 2 to 4 days he would have risen to the top and somebody would have seen his body on this lake, because this lake was very well populated. It was a tourist attraction. There was a hotel at one end, and he would come and stay at the hotel for the summer. And a lot of people there knew him really well. This was something he did every summer for years. There should have been people on that lake enough to see a body floating along. There just should have been, because there were literally dozens and dozens of people out there. And one of the features of going to this particular hotel was that they offered you canoes so you could canoe around the lake. And so it was a popular pastime. The area is called the Algonquin Park today. He has been seen supposedly floating along the lake in his gray canoe, and many people have reported seeing this man. He seems completely solid and real. People, how you doing? Wave. He nods to them or waves back and smiles, still floating along on his lake. Now, doesn't sound like a big deal, does it? However, this is suddenly a big deal. I would like to read the last paragraph of this particular story. The most famous sighting of Tom Thompson happened in 1980, and it was captured on film by artist Douglas Dunford. He was at the dock at Canoe Lake early in the morning to take photographs. It was a thick fog that enveloped the area, reducing visibility to only a few meters. At some point, Doug became aware of the noise of what he said was an oar slapping the water. And he examined the fog, looking for somebody to come out of the fog in a canoe, thinking how strange you'd be out there paddling along in this deep fog. At that point, a man in his canoe suddenly emerged. Without thinking, Doug, a professional photographer, lifts the camera to his face and begins to snap photographs of this figure. And he has no idea that what he's doing is going to have an impact. But he reveals a person. Now it's backlit, so you see the man. He's almost a silhouette. You can see his beanie, his jacket. He's paddling. I'm looking at the photograph, by the way.
Okay.
And coming out of the fog. And he showed the picture around at the lake, and old people recognized this guy as Tom Thompson. And this photograph would be made famous by that photographer, Doug Dunsford, because he was also an artist, a painter. And he painted a very famous painting, a watercolor, based on that photograph. And the photograph still exists. You can look it up. It's amazingly clear. There is a reflection of the gray canoe in the water. It's solid. I mean, the things I would look for as a paranormal person, it's reflective, meaning it reflects light. It's solid. The background is white because it's the fog and the light bouncing off the fog. You can see his hands. You can see his facial features. To some extent, you know, you can make out this is definitely a male, and he's just paddling along. And there was nobody on the lake that morning because it was too foggy. The hotel had pulled all the canoes so no one could canoe there. It's an amazing picture. It's one of the best. If it's truly legitimately this guy, and I have no reason to say it isn't, it's one of the best paranormal pictures I've ever seen in my life. It's just mind-bogglingly clear. And if this is true, then wow. But it's a fascinating photograph. I can't wait for everybody to look at it. It was actually the first story I collected for this series of stories. And today I was looking at the lineup, and I usually just start at the beginning and work my way through the stories I really like. And all of a sudden I was like, nah, we're ending on this puppy, not beginning with it. That's the best for last. So that is my last story. And I hope everybody takes the time to go and take a look, because it is an amazing photograph.
I said I will put a link down if it's available on the internet. I'll put a link
it
down,
is.
Which is easily done. So,
yeah, it is.
Okay.
So that's my last tale for tonight.
All right. Well, then, just a reminder. Please click that subscribe. Please click the bell, and check out our link tree. And with that, I'll say good night.
Good night, everybody.